Oh, good morning, everybody. So I'm curious right off the bat, how many Chiefs fans are in the room? I need you to keep your hands up so the ushers can escort you out of the room. No. But my daughter did marry a huge Eagles fan, so we're going to hang out today. It's going to be fun, everything. Yeah, see, somebody got excited. Like, the Chiefs fans are like, my hand's up, but I'm not saying anything, you know. But the Eagles fans, they'll be all excited about it. So it should be fun. But we're not here for the Super Bowl today. We're here for something even better than the Super Bowl. We started a series last week that I have titled Upside Down and Backwards. And if you reduced it down, really what it's about is the greatest sermon ever preached by the greatest preacher who's ever lived. And while I hear that and I go, that's far from anything that would qualify for me, I do look at that preacher, Jesus, and I do look at that sermon, which is the Sermon on the Mount, and I go, I want that to be more of my life. You know, one of the reasons that I wanted to do this series is because it is a section of the scriptures that I find, at least in my life, to be incredibly compelling. Not that I have reached it, not that I've achieved it, not that I'm always consistent in it, but it's one of those things where it's like it's a motivator. Like every time I go through it, it reminds me of what I most want to be in life, what I most want to do. And even though I'm going to stumble and fall, it's like I want to get back up and try to get that in my life more, just have it grafted in. Now, if I simplified what I think the Sermon on the Mount is, I think it's a series of backward-isms, right? It's like this series of statements where when you read them, you go, how does that work in the real world? Or you might even read them and say, there's no way that works in the real world. It's too backwards. It's too strange. It is too just outside of the norm. I mean, like you start reading this and Jesus is like, hey, when somebody slaps you across the cheek, give them the other cheek. Or if somebody sues you, pay them double. Or if somebody forces you to go 1 mile, you go the extra mile. You go above and beyond that thing. That makes no freaking sense whatsoever. Not in the real world. Like, it just seems like they're platitudes, they're silly, they're strange. And yet, here's the thing I also know. For anyone who has ever decided to believe in that message, to take up that thing and to test it, we actually find that against the odds, it works. It works. So I am heavily influenced my own kind of Christian thinking by the early Christians. Like, I think they had something going on that was unique. And when you look at them, they said, hey, the Sermon on the Mount is our jam. It's how we live. It's what we do. It's uncomfortable. It's awkward. It doesn't seem like it's going to work. And yet, over the course of time, they just kept sustaining a campaign of being like Jesus, and it changed an entire empire that was opposed to them and tried to destroy them. It literally transformed them. Maybe closer to our time, if you look at the writings and kind of the approach culturally of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., you will see that he was massively influenced by the Sermon on the Mount. He's like, the only way we're going to change this culture is not fighting fire with fire, but we're going to come in a different way, an upside down and backwards way. We're going to use this pacifistic approach. And from that, it confronted an American culture, and it really did start a change in things. I even look at somebody like Gandhi, who was not a Christian, but he looked at Jesus' message here, and he's like, that's what we need to do to deal with the British. And so he took up this mantle of living out this thing that Jesus articulated, and from that, it brought systemic change to his culture. And so what I think at the core of the Sermon on the Mount is it's a message about power through powerlessness. It's saying everything that you think changes things and accomplishes things, we're going to spin that, and we're going to show this powerlessness as the way to really bringing transformational power. So in that sense, that's one of the reasons I kind of sit up and listen when I think about the sermon. So it's one of the reasons that I like it. But for me, it runs deeper than that. There's a couple of reasons it runs deeper. One is, I think it's a funny section of the scriptures because it's an equal opportunity inspirer and offender all at the same time. Like, for example, I know followers of Jesus that love certain parts of the Sermon on the Mount, but then others, they go, yeah, no way, I'm not doing that. That's silly. I also know people that have no faith. They'll look at the Sermon on the Mount, and there's some parts of it they go, yeah, that's crazy, but other parts are like, ooh, that's really good. It's strange. Like, I know a lot of disbelievers, one of their most memorized passages is, "Do not judge, lest you be judged." Right? And they'll pull that one out all the time. They love that one. Right? Now, sometimes we as Christians, we don't so much because we love to judge a little bit, just a little. Right? So we're like, I'm going to clean that one up a little bit. Right? But we love that one on don't lust, and Jesus is going to get into lust, where the world sometimes is like, why are we making a big deal about that? So I just like it for the fact that it just doesn't play by the normal rules of tribalism. It's like, no, I'm going to inspire everybody at some point. I'm going to offend everybody at some point. That's the brilliance of Jesus' message. If I was to dive, though, just a little deeper into why, for me, it resonates. It's because if I was to look at this entire library and try to figure out the place where I could see the clearest articulation of what it is I am to be and to do as a follower of Jesus, this is that place. Right? If somebody said, hey, Matt, just distill it down, bro. There's a lot of sections of the scriptures. There's a lot of commands. There's a lot of examples. Just give me this one place to camp out for a while and try to master so I know what it means to follow the master who is Jesus. Like, give me that place. I'd say, this is the place right there. These three chapters in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 5, chapter 6, and chapter 7, this has become really profound for me. So I'm going to give you a little bit of my story, just a tiny bit of my origin story. Come to faith in a youth ministry with a youth pastor that just loved me fiercely and recklessly when I was a moron, right? He was just that guy. And then eventually I decide I'm going to go into pastoral ministry, but I go into that environment in a very rigid, a very legalistic environment with all of the rules and all of the theology, and we are more right than everybody else, and that's where I camped for a long time. And from that, I was loaded with this notion that how I knew a person was a faithful Christian is if they had the right way of interpreting the Bible, they had the right theology as we defined it, and I would look at everything through that lens. Oh, they're good Christians because they're Calvinists, or they're good Christians because they're evangelicals, or they're good Christians for these things that were kind of put in my mind as the way to measure. But then a few years ago, I started looking around at some of the people that I saw as the giants of my shared faith. And I was struck by the fact that so often when I would read them or listen to them or hear them preach, I heard a lot of things, but I didn't hear a lot of Jesus. Like, Jesus was referenced, but his heart and his tone and his compassion and his care and his vision for the world, I'm not hearing so much. And so then I started thinking about more, like, why do I use those as the metrics of a faithful follower of Christ? The real metric should be those who look like Jesus. Because that's the outcome. The outcome is not I can pass a theology test. The outcome is not I can define the right ethics for society. The outcome is, hey man, do I think like Jesus, feel like Jesus, act like Jesus, face the world like Jesus, face hurt like Jesus, whatever it is? Because if that's what I'm really meant to be, then I want to have that be my governing drive in life. I found that I was just so disposed to be religious that I wasn't using Jesus enough as my measuring rod. And what I love about the Sermon on the Mount is I think it really is the articulation of Jesus. It's almost like an autobiographical sketch of this is what he was and what he did, and we as his followers, we want to do the same thing. And so we find Jesus, he comes onto the horns of Hattin, that is the region where he goes up to a mountain, and he's giving this decree, this manifesto on what we are to say and to do and how we are to live. And so that's why we're doing this big series. We're trying to figure out how do I partner with what he's doing to be a part of the reshaping and reforming of the world that he's bringing to bear through our lives and into the lives of others. And so with that, I want to remind you, we do have an app. And in the app, not only are there notes, but for this entire series, I'm peppering into the notes like podcasts from the Bible Project. That was a little crack in my voice. I'm 13 again. Last week we looked at some of the Bible Project, and so every week there's going to be podcasts you can listen to and just ways to kind of layer and reinforce this, because I do think this message is that important. And so with that, I'm going to go ahead and pray, and we're going to dive right into what we have today. So Jesus, I look to you. I look to you as much as we're looking at your message in layers. I'm asking you to peel back kind of the layers of us. Our layers of presupposition, our layers of resistance, our layers of wound and hurt, our layers of cynicism, our layers of lack of faith, whatever it is. peel that stuff back, get to the deepest core of our inner us, and implant into us a passion for what it is you want to do and what it is you want to do in and through us. And I know that in doing that, we're going to be blessed by you for it. We're, even when it's hard, we're going to feel a sense of peace from you. And so all the more, I'm just asking that you will work in a very powerful way over the course of these next several months as we dissect, deep dive, and then hopefully apply what it is you have for us. And so I'm just asking you today to settle our hearts, teach us by your Spirit, show each and every one of us what you have for us as individuals so that we can collectively be more of what you want us to be in this world. And so Jesus, we thank you and we praise you and we just welcome you into the space in our lives now in your good name. Amen. All right, so last week we kind of kicked off with an introduction, right? And we looked at kind of the social historical context as Jesus is emerging onto the scene and the things that are going on. But I want to just kind of recap that really quick, right? So if you're taking notes today, it's just starting with a little bit of a recap of the conditions that lead up to the Sermon on the Mount. Because when the writer of Matthew is putting this together, he's got a flow of thought. And so in chapter 4, we saw that first of all, Jesus comes to a region of national and class diversity, right? So it's in the Galilee of the Gentiles. So it's Jewish, but it's also non-Jewish. And people from as far as Syria are coming, but it's right under the nose of the Roman occupation as well. So it's a place where everybody is kind of collected in one space. It's very diversified in that sense, and it's rich to poor, you name it. It's slave to free. So he's in an audience that is global in scope, even though it's in a very finite space geographically. From this, we see that Jesus gathers an assembly of unlikely change makers, right? The demon-possessed, the sick, the impure, outsiders, insiders, you name it, they're coming. They're enthralled with what's going on. And so from this, Jesus challenges. And he challenges the masses to reconsider the kind of community that can change all communities. And I want you to get that anchored. I want you to understand that the real core of the mission is not just that, hey, I take the Sermon on the Mount seriously, but rather we collectively are embracing this kingdom way in such a way that the community at large, Duval, Carnation, Redmond, Monroe, wherever you're from, Woodinville, that they can look and go, there's something different happening in that place with those people. They're a new kind of thing than what we're used to. It's a different from the norm. And we want to lean in to take note of that. And so that's what Jesus is seeking to do. And as he rolls in and he begins to preach, he distills down his initial message in a very simple way. And it's said in a way that their ears would hear it a little different than ours. And so I want to read it as their ears would hear it. He says to them, think different. That's the word repent. Think different. You are wired a certain way. You perceive a certain way. You have biases in a certain way. And I'm going to upend all of that. So he says, I want you to think different. And I want you to believe that the good news of the reign of the skies will press back the darkened rulership of the land. So he puts everything in terms of heaven and earth. Or literally in Greek, the heavens and the earth, which is why we're translating it as the skies. Now, in this, part of it is just realizing that those are two very different realms, right? And if you kind of understand the way they saw things, the skies is where God dwells. The skies are unattached or untouched or untapped when it comes to the hurt of the land, the brokenness of the land, the sin of the land, right? Remember, in Genesis, God curses the earth. He doesn't curse the skies. He curses the land. He still resides in the skies, but the lands are what are wounded. And now Jesus is coming in and he's like saying, hey, I'm going to bring the wholesome healing that is from above down below. And I'm going to see that transform the down below so that the down below is once again going to be re-merged with the skies above. It's just juxtaposition. So he's like, man, you got to understand that the way we're going to transform this world is going to look really different than the way that you understand. Yeah, man, life is broken. Life is decay. Life is hurt. But the way of the skies, the kingdom of the heavens, the reign of those things, can push back the darkness and break forth the light. And that's why it says he went into this region where death had cast its shadow. He went into a region that was in darkness, and now the light is shining as he begins to move and heal and touch and to preach and everything else. And what he's bringing with that is a new kind of thinking, a legitimate new kind of thinking for a new kind of living, for really to display a whole new way of seeing news that is good, and a community that then takes that good news and passes it around. That's kind of the essence behind this whole thing. And so from this, Jesus kind of speaks in this cryptic upside down and backwards way. And he's like, okay, you got to see the world differently. You got to flip your vision. You got to think sky. You can't think land. And I'm sure the crowds are hearing that and they're going, yeah, right, cool. We got to think different. What does different mean? Right? Because if I said that to you, hey, y'all, you need to think different. You'd be like, great. Now anchor that in something. Get granular. Get into the details. And that's then what Jesus does. So he's got this following. They're curious. They're leaned in. They want to get it. And so one day when he saw the crowd gathering, he went up on the mountainside and he sat down. And then his disciples gathered around him and he began to teach them. Now, one of the things we noted last week is that as a writer, Matthew, he's got limited resources, right? So he's only has so much paper and he only has so much ink. He can't be wasteful. And so he doesn't just write things for narrative flow, like, all right, he went up, he sent that. No, all of this has like a layer of meaning. And for the audience that is familiar with things, man, this all means something. This idea that he went up, that he sat down, that he began to teach. It reminds them of other previous times in the Hebrew scriptures where there were these images. And we link this to like three mountains. There was the mountain where Moses went up and received the law. And there was the mountain where David went up and he received the kingship as king. And so when Jesus does the same thing, everybody's going, whoa, bro, wait, I see a link. I see connectivity between those previous events that were major movements of God and now this guy rolling in and doing these things. It echoes something historic. And so now as Jesus goes up and he sits down, he is seen as a new king, bringing in a new kingdom. With this, he brings a new law for a new blessed way. So much so that that's where he begins. He begins with the idea of blessed or blessing. That's the anchor point that he kicks off with. And so, again, what happens here, you got to understand, in the rabbinical world, Jesus goes up and when he sits down, that's like, man, I'm going to teach serious now. Like in our culture, we stand to teach. But in their world, the rabbi would sit. And as soon as the rabbi sat, they're all like, ooh, this is going to be deep. This is going to be big. This is going to be something that we want to pay attention to. And so with this, he issues this series of statements about blessing. He says, blessed are the dot, dot, dot. And he gives nine different areas of blessing. Now, in Christian tradition, we call these the Beatitudes, which is just a Latin play off of just the word blessed. Right? So in that sense, it's not unique. But what I've realized is that this word blessed, it has bandwidth when it gets used. Right? It can be anything from when we're having a meal, we sit down and we do what? We bless it. We bless the food. Or we might say, God bless America. And we have certain ideas that are layered in there. When somebody sneezes, what do we say? Bless you. Weird, right? I just issued a blessing because you sneezed snot all over me. All right, so, which is interesting, you go back and look at the history of that, it's because people believed that when you sneezed, you were inviting a potential spirit into your life, so they blessed you so that you didn't get possessed when you sneezed. Which I would say it should happen before, not after, because if any time it's going in, it's on the, not the, boom, right? So, but that's it, right? You're going to think about that now. As soon as you see somebody starting to go, that's when you say it, and that's what stops it, too. So, blessing for sneezing. Another one we use it for is we'll say, bless your heart, which means idiot, right? Like that's, they're an idiot. Bless their pee-picking little heart, right? That's in there. Or we'll even do hashtag blessed when we put some kind of, I don't know, picture on social media or some whatever. Like, we use it in all these sorts of ways. And so we're kind of loaded up with this idea that the word has a lot of bandwidth. But in Jesus's culture, it had more particularity maybe associated with it, right? It was more loaded up to kind of see things in a certain way. Let me just give you the generic definition. It doesn't matter if it's Hebrew or Greek. So the Hebrew Old Testament was written in Hebrew. The Greek New Testament was written in Greek. There's also a Greek version of the Old Testament. And these words all kind of have the same basic association. So it means things like happy. Blessed can mean happy or fortunate, favored, or praiseworthy. I would say one of the better ways to see this word as it's a description of the good life. The good life. So it's like, hey, you do these things and you're going to be blessed. You're going to have the good life. And that would be a good articulation of this. So in that sense, you go, well, that's pretty straightforward. I kind of get that. But underneath this, there is a deeper meaning for the Hebrew mind. Right? And the deeper meaning really comes down to a question. And it's not just a question of the Hebrews. It is the existential question that all human societies wrestle with, which is, how do you discern, achieve, and maintain the blessed good life? Right? How do you do that? And I'm going to raise that question to all of us right now. Like, if you're put on the spot, somebody is saying, hey, tell me, how does one enjoy the good life? What would be the things that you would articulate? What would be the values or the norms, the dispositions, the priorities, the social constructs that would make for the hashtag blessed life? See, this is a big question. Here's what I can tell you. Every major culture has wrestled with this. All of the ancient cultures, all of the modern cultures, right? I mean, this is the question. And people have debated this. Societies have tried different attempts at really formulating this and accomplishing this and sustaining this. It's all in there. Every one of those cultures have. And think about this, just from kind of a sociological perspective, how they've tried to then see the good life accomplished. Way, way back, it was always monarchies. It was kings. That's how you're going to have the good life. A lot of those ancient societies, that's exactly what they did. But then we saw a little bit more diversity as we get closer to our time. And so from that, we've had anything from democracies to dictatorships. And every one of those is saying the same thing. This is how you get to the good life. And so it asks the question, is capitalism the road to the good life? Is socialism the road to the good life? Is communism the road to the good life? Because when you read Marx, that's what he's saying. When you read Smith, that's what he's saying. This is how we have the good life. Do we have good life because we offer freedom? Or is it because we offer constraint? Or is it really found in moderation? Is the good life found in pacifism or activism or couch potatoism? You know, like, what's the thing that creates it? How do you measure it? Do you measure it by economic power, emotional health, military security, educational standards, family unity, social equality? Like, what is it? Here's what I was thinking about. If you look at us as a culture, you would think that, man, then we should be happiest, most blessed. Because we're number one on a lot of fronts, economically, technologically, educationally, as far as secondary education, where you really get skills and trades that can kind of manifest. There's all these positives we have. But when you look and go, hey, what nation is the happiest on earth? Not us. Not number one. We're not number five. We're not number 10. We're not number 15. We're not even in the top 20 anymore. And we're trending further away. So if blessed means happy, and yet the stats show us that we're not happy, in fact, we're becoming more anxious, more heavy laden, more downtrodden, then there's something that makes us go, then what leads to the good life? Weirdly enough, 9 of the top 10 are all Scandinavian. Maybe we should take some notes. They've all figured something out that we haven't figured out, but I don't think they've even quite figured out what the real thing is. But I think it's felt. I think this want of the good life is felt in the soul, because the soul longs for something more. We just don't know how to get to it, and we don't know how to maintain it, so we try all the different things, right? All the different economies and all the different hobbies and all the different whatever. And yet here's what I also know about God. God looks on the scene, and he sees our waywardness, and he sees the hurt and the damage that it brings, even in our own souls and in the souls of others. And he's like, here's the good news, kids. I've got a plan to bless you. I have the desire, the want, the agenda to bless you. So much was this God's heart that we see early in the story that we lose blessing and we have this curse thing happening. But by Genesis 12, God rolls into Abraham and he says, I'm going to make a nation. I'm going to bless that nation so that nation will bless all the nations of the earth. So here's our tag word again. When I go blessed or blessing was a major word to the Hebrew scriptures, it starts in the earliest days. There's a curse in the land, but God wants to come and bless in the land again to remove the curse of the land and bring blessing to the land. And he's going to use a nation to do that. So he's setting aside Israel for that purpose. And so after they've left Egypt and their hundreds of years of slavery and they're going into their ancestral home, we call it the promised land, Moses speaks on behalf of God and he says this in Deuteronomy 4. He says, God let you hear his voice from heaven so he could instruct you. He let you see his great fire here on earth so he could speak to you from it. Because he loved you and your ancestors, he chose to bless you as their descendants. So he tells Abraham, I'm going to bless you and your people. And so now the blessing is coming, but there's a purpose for the blessing. He says, look, I am now teaching you these decrees and regulations just as the Lord my God commanded me, so that you may obey them in the land that you were about to enter and occupy. He says, obey them completely, and this is the cool part, obey them completely, and you will display your wisdom and intelligence among the surrounding nations. And when they hear all these decrees, they will exclaim, how wise and prudent are the people of this great nation. And so suddenly now, it's not just about God wants to bless a nation, but he wants to bless a nation. So the surrounding nations go, dude, whatever you guys are doing works. Whatever's happening in your corner of the world, you're doing life different. You're a different kind of community doing a different kind of thing in a different kind of way. And it's compelling. It's wooing us in. We're saying, I don't know what it is, but I want whatever it is. So in other words, what God wants to do with Israel is make a new kind of people. And if they do things his way, they will be that new kind of people. He will bless the people who will then compel others to want to seek the same blessing in the same way. So then you fast forward in Deuteronomy to chapter 28. You start to see the blessings. He says, you fully obey the Lord your God and carefully keep his commandments that I'm giving you today. The Lord your God will set you high above the nations of the world, and you will experience all these blessings if you obey the Lord your God. He's like, man, if you do my thing, in my way, you feel my jam, you live it out, you're going to have the good life. And then he goes into this listing of the good life things. And here's a whole list of things. I've kind of modernized some of these, right? These are all the things in Deuteronomy 28. There'll be a superpower in status, numerical in strength, provision and multiplication, security and protection, military superiority, economic prosperity, spiritual notoriety, you name it. This whole list of things is all in chapter 28. Like, you look at that, even from our own modern perspective, we go, that would be the good life. In the lay of the land, that'd be pretty sweet. Now, here's what we know about Israel. They did not ever experience this list, really. It never really came about in a sustained way because they were unfaithful. They were unholy, which means, holy just means you're supposed to be uncommon. They became common. They just looked like everybody else. And from this, they were unblessable. And that pattern, that stayed, right? So from the earliest days all the way on for like 1,000 years, it was highs and lows, peaks and valleys, started to be blessable, and then coughed up the blessing, right? It was just always the same problem. And so when Jesus is rolling into that time period, what was still true is everybody had the plaguing question. How do we experience the good life? How do you achieve it? How do you maintain it? How do you sustain it? What does it take to have that finally come about in our lives? And so all the different groups in the time of Jesus were wrestling with that question, and they were coming up with different answers. They all had a different solution on how we are blessable again. Take the Pharisees. Their solution was conservative religious practice. They're like, you know what, if we could just get back to that, man, we're gonna unlock the blessing of God. Now, the challenge with that is the Pharisees would look at a lot of the sick and the impure and the outsider, and they'd say, they're in the way of blessing. They should conform or just be banished, but we need to have new standards reapplied so that there's blessing. That was their solution. The Sadducees said, no, we need more liberal political alliances. So they were working with Rome, and they were kind of greasing the skids and everything else. They're trying to make sure that, hey, we can kind of keep power, but kind of align with other power, and together we'll have power, and that's going to create the blessing that we want. The Zealots, they hated that. So the Zealots, they wanted patriotic military conquest. They were like the freedom fighters of the day. Rome would call them terrorists, and they would call themselves patriots, right? And that's the way they thought they would get God's blessing unlocked. Then you had the Essenes. They said, no, we just need a withdrawal. We need cultural isolation, right? We don't want to be in the world. We don't want to be of the world. We don't want to be near the world. And God will unlock blessing if we just go and we hide out. We have our own space someplace, and then God will do his thing. Oddly enough, it wasn't just Jewish people that were trying to figure out the good life. Like I said, every civilization ever has tried to wrestle with this. And so the Romans had ideas too. They said, no, man, I'll tell you how the good life comes. It's social diversity, economic security, and military superiority. That's how you're going to see it accomplished. And so all the way through, it's always the same thing. Go to our own culture. The Americans, the inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This is just the way we're all trying to figure out. How do you create blessing in the land? Now, of that list, let's just do it, A, B, C, D, E, and F. Like, which of these will do it? Which is the way forward for all of us? See, I'm sure probably based on our political proclivities and our financial philosophies and things like that, we could probably pick out one of the letters. It makes perfect sense. But Jesus will say, G, none of the above. That none of them quite fit, none of them quite work. That isn't to say that, oh, those are all bad ideas. But what he's rolling in with is something so radically different that he's going to tell us at the end of the message, ah, oh, you guys, this is a hard and difficult way. It's narrow. It's challenged. Many will look at it and in the end say, psh, it's just too far. It's too much. They're not going to choose it. Many will see it, but many won't choose this way that he's laying out. But for him, it is the way. And so what the Sermon on the Mount is doing is it's giving the uncomfortable divine answer to the question of how do we see the good life. And what Jesus is going to say is the blessed good life only flows by obeying the upside down and backwards lifestyle outlined in the Sermon on the Mount. That's the only way you can have true, deep, sincere blessing. Now, what I think is interesting is if you overlay Jesus and Moses, you see they both kind of say similar things in their epic messages, right? So Deuteronomy is really Moses's, Sermon on the Mount is really Jesus. Right? And they're using familiar vernacular, but it's going to be a little different. So when it comes to Moses on the mount with the old law, here's what he basically said. He says, when it comes to what God is saying, obey them completely, these creeds, and you will display your wisdom and intelligence among all the nations, and then from that, God's going to bless you. So blessing and wisdom and obedience are locked together, right? So the audience is hearing Jesus, but they're going to hear him through that grid, and therefore Jesus uses similar language. On this mountain, now Jesus is saying, blessed are the, he's going to give a list, and he says, anyone who listens to my teaching and follows it is wise. So again, connectivity, wisdom to wisdom, obedience to obedience, blessing to blessing. Here's the difference, and I want you to pay attention for a second. Under the old code of Moses, prosperity and security would come when you were religious and kind of ceremonially pure, that you were crushing it on all those fronts. And that's the way they would normally think. So in their culture, if you were sick, if you were possessed, if you were poor, it's because God had cursed you. But if you were wealthy and powerful, it's because God had blessed you. That's the way they saw it. And they're running it through this grid of Moses. I think their vision was broken because there's a bunch of other stuff God says to them and they blew that off. But they're thinking so much about their own prosperity and security, they're just saying, hey man, God blesses those who are strong and God curses those who are weak. But now Jesus rolls in and he's going to flip the entire script. Because who's gathering around him? Right? We already saw that audience, man. They're the sick. They're the poor, they're the outsider, they're the branded, they're the broken. Right? They're the ones that religion would look at and say, you're the problem. The reason God isn't blessing Israel is because you're a hooker and you're a tax collector. And you're, you know, there was just this judgment laid down and they're like, you are breaking everything. You are risking our blessing. And now Jesus has that very group of people surrounding him and he's going to say to them, man, you are the start of blessing. You are the catalyst, the key. You are the seed of a whole new kind of community that's going to enjoy and release a whole new kind of blessing. And so instead of Jesus rolling in and saying, blessed are the religious and blessed are the moral and blessed, he starts in a very weird place. He says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of the skies. Right? Not blessed are the mighty, blessed are the powerful, blessed are the wealthy, blessed are the religious. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of the skies. Here's the second thing in your notes. Jesus is saying the good life of Jesus is seen in those who are humbled by self-awareness. Self-awareness. See, sometimes the religious, the pious, the powerful can be plagued by certainty or superiority, self-sufficiency, self-righteousness, independence, whatever it is, right? And they think that that is going to be where God blesses them with the good life. And then Jesus is like, ah, man, no, no, that's not how it comes. It's not how it flows. Here's what he's saying here. The good life doesn't come through the exaltation of self. It comes through, ready? The death of ego. The death of ego. The slaying of ego. Whether that is Jesus slaying our ego or us going to war with our ego so it's slain, either way, that is where the good life comes. Right? Ego is the thing that gets in the way for all of us. I guarantee you, in my life, my biggest problem, the core of my sin, people say it's pride. I go, yeah, pride, but pride is a derivative of this idea of ego. Me first, self-defending, self-preserving, self-asserting, whatever. Like, that's the thing that gets in the way. I can't forgive another person because I got this thing in me that's got to hurt, you know? I get it. I feel it. I know it. I know it's in me. It's just this thing that does not unleash blessing. In fact, when you look at Jesus' invitation repeatedly, he's going to war with this ego in us, right? So think about some of the things he says. If anyone would want to follow me, they have to take up their cross and deny themselves. Then follow me. That's the slaying of ego right there, right? He says, you want to gain life, real life, true life, blessed life? Lose your life. If you want to gain it, you got to lose it. You want to be first, you got to be last. You want to be great, you have to be the least. All of those things are articulations of poor in spirit. That's it. People will wrestle through, what does it mean to be truly poor in spirit? What is the deep meaning? Death of ego. To realize that you're not all that, a can of spam, man, that you are dependent on the grace and the goodness of God. That is what it means to be poor in spirit. I take it a step further and say, if you've been touched by the grace of God, if I know the forgiveness of God, if I know what resides in me because I am ugly inside, if I know what's in there and he's still like, I love you, I forgive you, I embrace you, I bring you in as my kid, if he does all of that stuff, then what he's saying is, man, you want to know the good life? You also give that to others. To the same degree I've done this to you, you do this to them. You pay grace forward, man. Because again, when grace came into my life, I wasn't like pretty good guy. Or maybe I was a pretty good guy because it's funny, we always say that. Hey, I'm pretty good, which means not quite good enough. I'm pretty good, right? I'm pretty smart, not smart enough, right? Like, the pretty is the problem. I'm not completely what I'm supposed to be, and yet, in my failure, Jesus still showed me grace and says, all right, I want you to go do the same. Be gracious. See, I think the poor in spirit, it's kind of this enigma. They have a high pain tolerance when it comes to personal offense. Like, they just have a high pain tolerance when it comes to, hey, they're treated unfairly and they don't retaliate. But then they have this weirdly low entry point for displaying empathy. Right? So it's like, man, I can take it, but boy, I care about others who are in a harder place than me, and I'm empathetic toward them. The poor in spirit, they see what they do have, and then they seek to be sharing in that versus they're lamenting what they they don't have. The poor in spirit don't talk about what they've earned or what they deserve or what they've accomplished. They don't demand. They don't decry. But they do display appreciation for even the little things that God has done in their world, right? They see nothing as this idea, hey, of I'm privileged and I deserve a thing, but rather like, man, I'm privileged and I want to give a thing, right? That's where Jesus starts, and that's what you're going to see repeatedly in what he does. And so that's the poor in spirit. That's the way of the skies. And for those who are poor in spirit, they've embraced the way of the skies. They're like, that value system is my value system. I want to do that thing to the people around me, even though it's upside down and even though it's backwards. I want to do that. But in doing that, what does it do? It proves the kingdom of the heavens or the skies is truly theirs. See, that phrase there, it's in the present tense. All the rest of them are going to be future tense as far as what the dividend is, but this one is in the present tense because what it's saying is when you are truly poor in spirit, you believe this message. When you're truly poor in spirit, you are inheriting presently that idea of you're bringing the skies to the land. You're disrupting the normal flow with an uncommon way, right? And that takes poverty of spirit. Yet in that poverty of spirit, it's displaying faith and faithfulness in humility, dependency, and tranquility. Next, this is one that we're not good with. Jesus says, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. I love this because what it means is the good life of Jesus is displayed in those who are moved by good grief. They're moved by good grief. I'll tell you, as Americans, we recoil at this one. We try to avoid grief, suppress grief, distract grief, meditate grief. We try to get away from it. But here's the thing. I have learned over the course of my life that grief is good. That tears are therapy. That lament is actually a restore of the soul. I think some of our anxiety and depression, not all of it, we've talked about this so many times. I mean, there's reasons and times and places for other outlets, but I think some of the stuff in our life, it's like we so ward off grief, we bottle up all that stuff, and Jesus knows it. It's funny, as I've gotten older, man, I've become a crybaby. And it's really good. I'm like, I was missing this for years. What are we doing? It's so good. I mean, I bet in the last 6 months, I have shed more tears than the last 6 years. And while in the moment, it's like no fun, I realize, man, there is blessing. There is blessing when there is mourning. Now, here's what I want to specify about this. I think Jesus, it has a particular thing in mind. I can't spell out maybe everything he does. I don't know fully, but when I thought about this section here, I think the mourning is in relationship to seeing the hurt of the world, seeing people who are hurt and are hurting others in the world, and then from that, hurting over it. So you see people hurt, you see people doing the hurting, and then from that, as you see that, you hurt for them, right? I think there's an example of this even in Jesus, right? There's a couple of different times where we see Jesus weeps. So when he says, blessed are those who mourn, he mourns. In one circumstance, it's a friend of his that has died. And even though he's going to raise this bro from the dead, when he gets there, he's still weepy about the circumstance, that this is the plight of the human condition. Yes, one day it'll be undone, but for now it's in play. And when he sees it in play, and he sees the grief of the family and the hardship of all of it, it just causes him to weep. That's lament. That's healthy. That's good. But that's over his friend. The other time we see him weep, and I think this one is really gets my gears spinning. Jesus is riding into Jerusalem. It's the last week of his life. He's going to go to the cross. And as he's riding into the city, he begins to weep. And he's weeping because he sees the hardness of people's hearts. He sees the violence that is residing in them. He sees where this is going to go. And instead of him being, you know what, you all suck and you should burn because you're terrible humans. And I know what you're going to do to me. No, he's hurting over their sin. He's hurting over their folly. He's hurting over their blindness. He's hurting over their hardness. He's mourning because he sees how they are stewing up trouble for themselves. And even though it's going to be trouble that comes to him, even that breaks his heart. He's not mad at them. He's mournful for them. And I kind of look at that and I go, man, that's the message for us too. Right? That's the message, right? See, it's easy to get mad about things. It's tough to mourn over things. Like, how many of you, I won't ask you to raise your hands, but like, in watching the news in the last month, we're just perpetually brought to tears over stuff versus you're just mad at what you were hearing and seeing, right? Mad's easy. Frustration's easy. Umbrage is easy because there's a certain judgment in it. But Jesus offers something different. It's about seeing the faults and flaws of others and then feeling anguish for them more than agitation against them. Those are the blessed mourners. It's where they have righteous tears, not righteous anger. They weep for versus rant against. They pray over versus plot against. They hurt with and they hurt over others, but it doesn't then create a desire to hurt back in them. It's seeing humanity through the eyes of Jesus. I'm always mesmerized by the cross. I mean, there's a lot of parts of it that really grab me, but the thing that grabs me the most is here he is. You've got religion, you've got Rome, you've got the crowds, you've got your cowardly friends. They're all against you right now. It's some lair. One of your closest friends has betrayed you. And you have all the power of the universe, and you see with perfect clarity. And then in that moment, what's he do? He says, Father, forgive them. They don't even know what they're doing right now. Right? So there is a compassion and an empathy at a time where you could be like, you know what? I'm just going to unleash wrath. It's like, no, they don't even see their mess. And so he hurts over us more than he just wants to inflict wrath on us. Now, this doesn't mean that the mourners sugarcoat the problems of life, right? But it also means we don't grow hard or self-protective in the process of it. We do this knowing that, hey, man, it might be hard today, and I'm going to mourn maybe a lot in this life, but I also know that one day I'll be comforted. And that's his promise. So I think part of what the Beatitudes require, what the whole Sermon on the Mount requires, is genuine faith. I really believe that this is going to be the outcome one day. And so I lean in today to this outcome for one day. I mourn over the hurts and hardship of life because I know I will be comforted. And then third and last for today, Jesus says, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the land. Number four in your notes, the good life of Jesus is known by those who are powerful in gentleness. Powerful in gentleness. And this is very backwards, man. This is incredibly backwards, right? In our culture, it's assertiveness, it's aggressiveness, it's a sense of forcefulness where we get stuff done, we drive ahead, we are hard chargers, whatever else. And then Jesus rolls in with this upside down and backwards philosophy and goes, you want to know what real greatness is? Greatness is found in meekness. In meekness. It's so bizarre. Now, two reasons this is important. One is that Jesus describes himself this way. Like in Matthew chapter 11, verse 29, he says, hey, if you are weary, you're heavy laden, come to me because I'm meek. You want to know who the blessed meek are? They are the safe spaces for others who are hurting. That's the meek. That's the meek. They are the safe spaces for others who are hurting. That's the first thing you need to know. Second thing you need to know about meekness, meekness isn't weakness. Meekness is not weakness. It's actually the reallocation of strength for a grander purpose. Here's the way I describe it. A strong person can land a punch, and a weak person can get plowed over by a punch. But the meek person can take the punch, get up, and not want to punch back. Right? That's the difference. The meek person has the capacity to retaliate, but the strength to not. That's the meek. Which is going to come in real handy later when Jesus is like, oh man, when it comes to persecution, it comes to your enemies and what you need to do. Oh, you're going to need to be strong in a way that you don't realize. I'd say the meek are those who are the strongest of all. I was reading a really interesting thing about Martin Luther King Jr. when he was training people for facing all of the hate that they did. I literally went, this is meekness training. Because what he would do is he would train them to get a beat down and get up and get beat down again and get up and get beat down again and not retaliate. Non-retaliation is the way of meekness. I think that is such a wild idea. But that's what he calls us to. In fact, I think it's a sustained campaign of meekness in a world that is harsh and critical and mean that is the only thing that will change anything. But it's in doing that that we inherit the land, that we change the land so that one day we inherit it as God intended, heaven and earth touch in a whole new way. And so the good life is seen and felt among the poor, the mourning, and the meek. That's it. Pretty simple. The poor, the mourning, and the meek. But I want to round out with one last thing because I think it's important to understand this. And it's number 5 in your notes. What do the blessed blessings actually teach? What do they tell? Because we're reading these, but think about it. Would you say these are commands? Would you say they're proverbs? Or are they just ideas floating about, statements? It was, maybe a year or two ago, I was watching The Chosen. And I'm one of those advocates for it. I know some people are like, oh, it's not accurate. I'm like, oh, but it's helpful, you know? And sometimes you got to separate the two. And I think it actually has a lot of accuracy and it has a lot of helpfulness. And there was this scene. And I thought, this is a great way to understand this. And so it's just a scene where Jesus is going to articulate the Beatitudes and kind of the why of the Beatitudes. Go ahead and check this out.
Matthew.
Rabbi.
I've got it.
The opening?
Yes.
What is it?
A map.
The what?
Directions. Where people should look to find me.
Okay. Give me a moment. Rabbi,
blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward will be great in heaven.
Yes. But how is it the map?
If someone wants to find me, those are the groups they should look for.
I think that's probably one of the best articulations I've ever seen of what they're doing. They're not telling us to go do things. They're telling us that we're to be certain things. These are articulations of disposition, not just simply commands of execution. And so I close out this morning with a question. Let's bring this question up on the screen here. What does Jesus need to undo in you so he can do a new thing through you? So I look at these Beatitudes, and we'll do more in the next couple of weeks, but I look at those, and they're like the North Star by which I navigate. I'm not going to reach that, but I want to navigate by that, and I want that to be my disposition and our disposition so that the world, as they interact with us, they go, there's something different. You're a blessing, and I can't put my finger on it why, but there's something about your disposition and your demeanor and your way you're doing life, and it's going to be those Beatitudes. And so right now, I just want to pray over all of us, myself included. And so Jesus, I ask you to do heavy lifting. I ask you to bring your loving surgery. I ask you to challenge our status quos. I ask you to drop our barriers. I ask you to alleviate our dispositions of defensiveness, whatever it is, whatever it takes, so that we can be what it is you want to really accomplish in us, that we will inhabit these dispositions, that you will inhabit us to really bring these dispositions. So give us what we need. Speak into us the things we need to hear. Remove out of us the things that we need to unload so that we can be what it is you've called us to be. We thank you, Jesus, for your challenge and for your grace. In your good name, amen.